recognize some that you hardly even heard of. People who worked and suffered and struggled for fame.
All right. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It is a Monday morning, so that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We have a Blackhawks Express to play back from last night's game as well. And we are also going to talk about some top-selling novelty gifts of all time, and we'll get to some SNL talk as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And we would love to hear from you. Monday also means it's the Monday morning movie reviews, and we'll also talk box office. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me every Monday morning to talk movies, and let's get the guys on now. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Steve. Welcome back, Steve.
Hello.
All right. Let's get to it. Well, Steve, why don't you tell us about The Kingmaker?
Oh, of course. This The Kingmaker is the latest documentary from director Lauren Greenfield, who made two really interesting films about worshipping wealth and wealth culture and the people that do that and live it. One was called The Queen of Versailles, which was probably the better known of the two, and the other one is called Generation Wealth, which is more recent. I guess it shouldn't be a surprise then that she has made her way to centering a film on the indomitable Imelda Marcos in The Kingmaker, who I think people might consider her the first lady of wealth. The film examines with a lot of intimate access the Marcos family's improbable return to power in the Philippines recently. And it also explores the sort of their disturbing legacy of her husband, Ferdinand Marcos's regime, and chronicles Imelda's sort of present-day push to push her son, Bong Bong, to win the vice presidency. To this end, Imelda sort of confidently and conveniently rewrites her family's history of corruption and stealing money directly from the Philippine people, and replaces it with a narrative of her sort of matriarchal, extravagant love for her country in an age where fake news manipulation can sometimes change elections. Imelda's comeback story sort of serves as a really dark fairy tale. She was a beauty pageant contestant who snagged this up-and-coming politician, and after 11 days of courtship in the mid-50s, she became his wife and has this sort of long famed history of loving luxury and the power behind her husband's sort of bloody and corrupt regime, which he also allegedly fleeced the nation out of billions, a lot of which sort of ended up in their pockets. But the director, in sort of gaining her subject's participation, it's pretty eager participation too. The director kind of rolls out this incredible tale with obvious parallels in the world, sort of in the current world's other political dynasties going on right now. It's crazy to see her, Imelda Marcos, as she sort of in her day was hobnobbing with people like and calling them her friends, people like Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi and Chairman Mao and Fidel Castro and even Presidents Nixon and Reagan, and even a younger Donald Trump. So the director not only has this sort of access to this 90-year-old Marcos and her family, but she gets to speak to her on subjects such as acquiring stolen art for the presidential palace and the government's continuing attempts to reacquire stolen money or property from the Marcos family, and then also when her husband was president, the necessity of jailing and even killing political enemies, especially those running against them. If you don't like the competition, just have them arrested as revolutionary traitors. That seems to be the way to go with them. There are scenes of Imelda Marcos driving or walking through these poor neighborhoods, just peeling off bills of cash and giving them to poor children that are swarming around her, and she thinks this is a good thing, but it's actually incredibly gross. And naturally, the documentary does sort of talk about her closets that are bursting with expensive gowns and, of course, shoes, which everybody knows her from. But if you think this is a documentary about a woman with a lot of shoes, you're in for a rude awakening. It's really about the way she controls people with this hidden fortune, and just gets what she wants for herself and her family, even still. And it's shocking how many of the Philippine people are still buying what this family is selling. If you think things are bad in this country in terms of corruption and influence peddling, wait until you get a load of what's going on in the Philippines and with the Marcos family, because man, they knew how to do it right, I guess. And the film is tremendous. it's terrifying, it's shocking, it'll make you angry, and it's playing at the Gene Siskel Film Center through Thursday, and then at some point it's going to land on Showtime, I think.
Yeah, it is a Showtime production. So, yeah. All right, well, there you go. That's The Kingmaker. All right, Eric, tell us about The Report.
Okay, The Report is a film that premiered at Sundance this year, and it stars Adam Driver as Daniel Jones, who in the late, sometime around 2000, no, I'm sorry, I got those dates wrong. Anyway, he's a congressional staffer who gets tasked with putting together a report that's basically going to detail the level of torture and things that were going on in the post 9/11 world. Sort of think about what was going on during Zero Dark Thirty, and this is the guy in the congressional chambers, basically going through investigating who these people were that were tasked with trying to find the information relating to bin Laden and how all these things basically got out of control. He's on the staff of Dianne Feinstein, who's played by Annette Bening, and this is a pretty stacked cast, with a lot of people playing characters in military intelligence, congressional intelligence, people who are on the ground committing these acts, as we follow him year after year trying to put together this gigantic report, and then ultimately how this report basically exposed so much that then it became a point of contention within the Congress that it was ever going to be released. It's really kind of interesting to see a lot of names attached to this period in history that have come up quite a bit now with our current administration, and sort of cast a new light on some of those people connected to both realms of history. So this is very much in the sort of an investigative, it's not journalism per se, but it is an investigative story about the really sort of terrible things that have gone on within our government, and it really becomes one of the best examples of this medium. Adam Driver as Daniel Jones, not the first time we're going to be talking about him tonight, but delivers a performance that in many ways is very heavy in exposition. He has to convey a lot of information throughout the film. Even though the director, Scott Z. Burns, who also wrote the movie, does a great job of interweaving the events of the past and his Jones's discovery of them. But Adam Driver has to sort of also represent the audience's sense of outrage that we begin to see. You know, anyone who might think that they have a predisposed manner of what they think torture actually is and how it was perceived during this time is going to walk away with a completely different perspective. And that's one of the great things that this movie does, is that Driver is able to sort of channel that outrage, and we see him getting more and more angry throughout the film, but never in a way that feels showy. It feels like a very natural reaction to the things that he's uncovering. This is a film that, even though it's very talky, it's very political, which will probably keep some people away. But as I said when I saw this movie at Sundance, when we talked about it back in January on your show, this is my favorite movie from Sundance this year. I think this movie is absolutely remarkable, brilliant in the way that it structures this entire, all these weird, these crazy events that were going on post 9/11, and how our government is just, you know, content through political parties and covering up their own asses, make sure that the American public never sees the light of day. And given, you know, what was going on when we saw this in January, it's even more relevant today. This movie came out before the Mueller report, now, or screened before the Mueller report came out. Now this is after the Mueller report. So there is a really very fascinating parallel now, even more so than before. But I think that this is one of the best movies of the year.
Okay. All right. You guys hang on, okay? When we come back, we'll find out what Steve thought of it and of the report. And we got more Monday Morning Movie Reviews coming up after this on WGN.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio here on 720 WGN, and we're talking movies. The Monday Morning Movie Reviews, my dad's going to tell a joke because it's Monday. We got a Blackhawks Express to play back and all kinds of cool stuff. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. Before the break, Eric told us about a movie called The Report, and now we'll get Steve's view on that. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right, Steve, what do you think of the report?
Yeah, I mean, it's exceptional. I think Eric and I might have even seen it together at Sundance. But I should say I'm looking at my bookshelf right now, and I have a 550-page executive summary of the Senate Intelligence Committee report on torture. So, spoiler alert, the people who tried to obstruct its release failed. I can at least say that much. But I think most people might know that. What's really interesting about this film is that, like, Scott Burns, basically by adhering to the facts in an almost religious, with an almost religious fervor, he makes, like, this incredibly believable and riveting thriller. And that's sort of hard to do with just a fact-based drama, which is mostly exposition and some flashbacks. But And I should make it clear that this character Jones, he wasn't just trying to talk about the nature of torture and what counted as torture. The most important thing for him was the effectiveness of torture, because if there was any proof in the CIA's documents that he was going through that any of the 100+ people, it was something like 150 or 160 people that they tortured, if any of them had given us any actionable information, he would have thought maybe this was a thing we could continue with. But that's the thing, is that none of that is there. There was absolutely no proof that this ever worked. And that's the thing that just enrages you. And I should mention, like there's like an almost impossible task here with the director to make this incredibly dense story with like 100 characters, it seems like maybe more, to just make it interesting, and it's just like this investigation thing, just make it interesting, and he does it. And I should say, like, at the center of this storm is like Adam Driver, who we're going to talk about again later, like Eric mentioned, and his other role in Marriage Story is probably going to get a lot more talk around award season. But honestly, he is no less remarkable in The Report. It's just a completely different kind of role, so we're really getting a range from him this week. I should also mention a couple other supporting players that really stand out. Ted Levine as CIA Director John Brennan is an amazing performance and character. He's just like an expert liar. John Hamm plays a White House Chief of Staff, mostly under Obama, I think, Dennis McDonough, who's really the one that's trying to keep the peace between the Republicans and Democrats, in terms of this report and sort of trying to appease everybody, which is an impossible task. And then Corey Stoll is Jones's attorney, because Jones gets accused of being a traitor at one point, of course. I wonder if that sounds familiar to the movie I just reviewed. But yeah, they try to throw him under the bus as a traitor, and yeah, Corey Stoll's really great as his very plain-spoken attorney. But yeah, this is a really remarkable film, and I believe it's, where is it? At the Landmark, right? Yeah, and it's going to be on Amazon Prime end of the month, I think?
Yeah, 2 weeks.
2 weeks, yeah. So, but it's tremendous, and I know it. I mean, I can imagine, like, watching a movie about torture or a torture report, and we do see some examples of it in the movie, in the flashbacks. Doesn't sound like the most interesting way to spend an afternoon or an evening at the movies, but, man, just go, because Adam Driver is, like, the coolest actor right now. Honestly,
right.
Like, it makes me more excited to see him in Star Wars the next month. So.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, there you go. That's the report, and two great reviews from there. Okay, Steve, tell us about The Good Liar.
Yeah, so you'd imagine that a combination of Helen Mirren and Ian McKellen acting in a film for the first time together would seem like a foolproof combination, especially in the hands of a director, Bill Condon, who has worked with McKellen on things like Gods and Monsters and Mr. Holmes, and even more recently in the live-action Beauty and the Beast. And while the two leads in The Good Liar are quite compelling when they're on screen together, there's a serious disconnect between them and the material that by the end is kind of unforgivable. We know pretty much from the opening that Roy Courtney, who McKellen plays, is a con artist who seems to target rich businessmen along with his professional partner Vincent, who's played by Jim Carter from Downton Abbey. They present what appears to be legitimate, lucrative investment opportunities and end up stealing fairly large sums of money from their marks. And it's their sort of knowledge of the language of business that makes them believable and a success for the most part. So we're never really quite sure initially if Roy has targeted this well-off widow, Betty, who's played by Mirren, who he meets on an online dating service. We don't know if he's targeted her because of her money or if he's actually looking to settle down with someone because he is, you know, he's a single man. But when he finds out how much money she has, he's immediately gets in touch with Vincent and starts trying to get her interested in investing her millions in ways that will supposedly make her a giant sum of money in a short amount of time. But along the way, the speed at which Roy and Betty become close worries her adult grandson, and there's even a part of the entire arrangement that makes us think Roy might actually be falling for her, or perhaps reconsidering ripping her off. At some point, we think his cover is blown when the couple and the grandson take a vacation to Berlin, and Stephen, the grandson's name is Stephen, he reveals that he's found out that Roy isn't all that he says. But when Roy explains things from a certain perspective, Betty is all the more drawn to him and his reasons for his deception, which have nothing to do with him trying to swindle her. It's just, but it's still pretty juicy. The Good Liar sort of falls apart in the third act big time, though. My biggest issue with the film is that under no circumstances could I buy Helen Mirren as a hapless, naive victim. She's built a career playing tough, intelligent, cunning characters, so I never quite bought that she would be taken in by Roy's plan to combine their finances and invest them together. But the bigger crime here, I think, is that when the entire truth about the situation is revealed, it's so convoluted and outlandish that I had a tough time accepting any of it, to be honest. And more importantly, the film turns into a bit of a mystery by the end that has given the audience absolutely no clues by which to solve it. I mean, I like having fun in my mysteries and playing along with them, and you can't, there's none of that here. We're just asked to accept this fairly insane reveal and just think, well, how about that? What do you know? But I actually, you know, the film doesn't really offer any opportunities to try to guess what's going on. Condon is usually a lot better, I think, with his storytelling skills, so maybe it's more a fault of the writing than the directing. But as a filmmaker, I kind of expect him to recognize that the shift in tone is so abrupt and jarring and maybe do something to ease the kind of gotcha moment rather than just sort of drop it on our heads. So if all you care about going to see The Good Liar is watch these two acting powerhouses come together, your wish will be granted tenfold. But if you'd actually like to see them interact in a worthy setting, this film is going to be something of a letdown.
Okay. All right, Eric, what do you think?
Yeah, this is not a good movie. It's almost as if Bill Condon threw Dirty Rotten Scoundrels and The Grifters into a juice extractor, and the only thing that came out was just the plotting, but everything everything except the sort of the sense of fun and even the sort of the cheekiness about it. And every once in a while, watching this movie, you kind of get the sense that that's a direction that Condon kind of wants to be playing with a little bit, especially in when he sees McKellen's sort of dealings up close, which the way they're presented just seem kind of silly. A bunch of people in a room, and they got a couple keypads. I mean, keypads are such a thing in this movie that is just so just ridiculous that no one uses a laptop or anything. They're all using these keypads and things to launder all their or to transfer all their money and whatnot. As if that's the only thing that an audience is going to be interested in. And then Steve is absolutely right about the sort of the third act, which is semi spoiled by the trailers a bit in suggesting that that Helen Mirren's character may not be all that she's cracked up to be, and as Steve said, that there's no way to not only not predict what where this entire plot has been sort of sprung from, but it also just sort of gives you an even worse reason to dislike one of the characters that just seems like you can't sit there and think, oh, there's no that there is an excuse for anything that this character has done in the past, but it almost seems unfair to him as a character to just sort of throw this upon us at the last minute and go like, oh, so we should feel bad about ourselves for maybe kind of wanting him to get away with certain things. It all completely falls apart by the end, like Steve said, and there wasn't much to keep apart or keep together to begin with. This is a pretty big pass for me.
Okay. All right, you guys, hang out, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Steve are here. We're reviewing the new movies. We got more going on here, and Monday morning movie reviews continue. And that was The Good Liar with Helen Mirren and Ian McKellen. Not very good, according to Eric and Steve. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back with more after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. My dad is going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time on this Monday morning. We have a Blackhawks Express to play back from a very exciting, good weekend for the Hawks. We're going to talk about some SNL stuff and some top-selling novelty gifts of all time. So, that's all coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. And it's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews is happening right now. And it's Eric and Steve, and let's get back to it. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay. Eric, tell us about Charlie's Angels.
Okay. Well, this is the latest incarnation reboot of the classic, if you will, 1970s television show with a bunch of beautiful women who just happen to be spies and go on adventures. The latest Angels begin with Kristen Stewart and Ella Balinska, who we see on a secret mission as the movie begins, and then we discover a little bit more about the agency itself. In fact, all of the Charlie's Angels versions that we've seen throughout time all seem to be connected in some manner. In fact, there's actually multiple Bosleys. We see the first Bosley in the movie is played by Patrick Stewart, who is the retiring Bosley, and he is going away, going his merry way, and the angels that we meet are taken over by Elizabeth Banks's Bosley. Banks also wrote, produced, and directed the movie. So the new the new adventure for the girls, or for the women, is this tech case of this woman played by Naomi Scott, who has developed this some sort of energy device that has a fatal flaw in it. In fact, it can cause gigantic seizures in people, and only a few people are aware of this, but of course the tech company still wants to go through with it. She's been hired by another sort of entrepreneur to sort of expose what's going on. The angels get involved, and everyone wants to basically kill each other, and then she ends up becoming the third angel. So we have two bona fide Charlie's Angels, and we have a newbie on the case, as they are going to put together who's exactly behind all of the murders and things, and, you know, go on their own merry ways. So, you know, Charlie's Angels, we're not exactly here for the plotting. We're here for the adventures, for the butt-kicking, maybe a couple chuckles along the way. And in the past, we've, you know, certainly delighted at the eye candy that the show was basically, you know, announced itself with, and has been sort of kind of a staple throughout the years. Although as we have grown as a society, there has certainly been a aura of feminism. Not that that wasn't existent in 1977, but it was certainly a mixture of the two things to get both sexes interested in this storyline. Here, the focus is pretty squarely on feminism, as evidenced in the very opening scene, as Kristen Stewart and even some of her marks are espousing a lot of tropes that we hear from time to time about you know, things that are going on in society and things that are absolutely supportive. But as the movie sort of progresses, it kind of just puts that aside a bit, and it just sort of feels like the entire enterprise just becomes more generic as it goes along. The only one here that I think is really sort of into this entire thing, beyond Banks, who's put everything into this, is Kristen Stewart. Her character, even though she is the lead, Naomi Scott's character certainly takes front and center throughout a good portion of this movie, and Stewart is really gives a really sort of unique comic flavor to her character. The line readings that are just kind of weird. She, you know, she just kind of gets the best quips in the movie. But the movie just becomes more and more bogged down with action scenes that are not exactly, nothing in the film really stands out. The plot goes on for, you know, a good 2 hours. You can guess exactly what's going to happen, who the surprise mystery villain is not hard to guess in the slightest. And it just, it ultimately just kind of fall somewhere in the middle. You know, we've had the McGee versions back in 2000 and 2003, and the first one I thought kind of struck the right balance of silliness that is kind of existed throughout this entire enterprise. Full Throttle, the sequel, was a lot uglier and a lot louder. It was not nearly as enjoyable, I thought. And this one kind of comes in somewhere in the middle. It's not really noisy. It's not really that silly. It's just kind of in the middle. And I think it's kind of a mistake to have a outsider be one of the three primary leads in the film. It just leads to sort of a naivete that an audience going in to see a Charlie's Angels movie doesn't really need. We kind of get what this entire thing is. We don't need her, you know, getting goo-goo-eyed at, you know, second closets full of clothes and stuff. So, yeah, so by the end, I just kind of shrugged, and apparently most of America did as well.
Yeah, okay. All right, Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, I liked it more, but it's not great, and I didn't love it. But I did like it. I mean, the only reason that I liked it as much as I did is because of Kristen Stewart. And I'm glad Eric was the one who had to explain the plot, because I don't even remember it anymore. the plot is arbitrary. It's pointless, and the villains are basically two-dimensional. I like what Sam Claflin was doing a little bit. He's the tech guy, the head of the tech company. I kind of like that he's taken this sort of bad guy turn recently. So, there's a bunch of predictable twists. But Banks, I think, as a director, understands that when she keeps focus on her leads, everything is pretty much all right. I think the only real interesting male character is this guy they call Saint, who's sort of part Q, part spiritual guru to the angels, and there's something so ridiculous about having a person like that in an action movie that it kind of works because it's new and unexpected. There's an early scene in the film where Kristen Stewart's character, Eric alluded to the moment where there's a discussion that's sort of about feminism, but she has a line in it where she says something about how being beautiful is an advantage in her job because no one suspects how dangerous she can be, and that is the entire end of the movie is sort of built around that in a really clever way, I think. And we realize that Charlie doesn't just hire pretty women because he likes having them around, he or she, I should say, but that Charlie knows that in a world run mostly by men, that these beautiful women are an asset to his intelligence gathering and just general spying. I got to say, though, but Kristen Stewart, man, after about 20 years of playing such serious roles, it's absolutely fascinating to watch her character emerge out of her with such unexpected layers. And she might be a sociopath, the character, but she's sort of weirdly sexy and quirky and kinky, and she has no real filters or boundaries when it comes to fighting bad guys or protecting her fellow agents. Things just come out of her mouth, and you like have to take a breath before allowing your brain to move forward sometimes. It's a tremendous comedic performance that doesn't really involve joke telling, but it absolutely informs the character. And I remember when I first saw the trailer for this film, I'm like, what the hell is she doing in this movie? And now that I've seen it, I get it. Like, she's trying something so different, and I applaud her for that. She's stealing the show and making the movie better than it has any right to be. By doing the unexpected and making it count for something. And, you know, as a girl power guiding light, you could do a lot worse, I think, than Kristen Stewart and Charlie's Angels. So.
Yeah, she's great. She's great. I love Kristen Stewart. I think she's fantastic. And I think she's by far the best thing in this movie. This is about as pedestrian as it gets. We've seen this stuff before. Elizabeth Banks doesn't do anything very special with the material. And, you know, I don't think we needed another Charlie's Angels. I really don't. You know, the two movies, I didn't like either of the movies. The TV show was, you know, whatever it was back in the 70s. I just don't see the need for another one. Apparently, Elizabeth Banks thought there was. But I'm almost recommending this just because of her, just because of Kristen Stewart. It's such a great performance, and it's funny, and it's weird, and it's awesome. But everything else about this movie is pretty much by the numbers and not surprising or, you know, nothing unique or anything like that. Doesn't add anything to the world of Charlie's Angels of any kind. But this performance by Kristen Stewart, she's become such an unbelievably interesting actress. You know, if you would have told me this, that I would find her one of the most fascinating actresses on the planet when the Twilight movies were out, I would have told you to shut up. But between her and Robert Pattinson,
we've had this conversation before.
It's unbelievable how far these two have come and what the kind of work they're doing. Robert Pattinson in The Lighthouse, one of the best performances of the year, mm-hmm. and she's great in this movie. And it's really, I mean, she's almost singularly the only reason to see it. I really love her. I think she's great. And the movie, not so so much, but she's great. So, all right, guys, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. All right, Eric and Steve are going to hang on. We're going to take a quick break. We got more movies to talk about on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio is here, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We got a Blackhawks Express to play back from last night's victory. Good weekend for the Hawks, man. And we've got we're going to talk about novelty gifts and some SNL stuff, too. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's the movie reviews with Eric and Steve, and let's get the guys back in. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Steve, tell us about Ford versus Ferrari.
Yes. Well, you know, I think we can all agree. At least I agree that we've gotten to the point where I just sort of trust James Mangold as a director. Like, I'm pretty sure he's going to get it right. I'm not saying every one of his films has been great, but like, he always finds a way to tell a story in a way that is revealing and informative and insightful. When you look at recent things like Walk the Line or 310 to Yuma, and both the Wolverine and Logan, and even going back to his earliest stuff like Heavy and Copland, the proof is there. His latest effort, he's returning to the realm of telling true life stories with Ford versus Ferrari, which chronicles one of the most important events in American car race design and racing, when the Ford Motor Company went head-to-head with the unbeatable race cars of Enzo Ferrari at the 24 Hours of Le Mans competition in France circa 1966. Honestly, I could care less about racing movies or movies about race cars, but if you skip this film because you think it's a racing movie, you're going to kind of be denying yourself what I think is a rare treat. Matt Damon plays former racer turned legendary car designer Carroll Shelby, who Ford hires to build a car that could not only be competitive at Le Mans, but actually win. Then Ford Motor Company head Henry Ford II, who's played wonderfully entitled and pompous by Tracy Letts, and his underling Lee Iacocca, who's played by John Barenthal, both trusted Shelby implicitly, but also repeatedly poisoned the process of testing various prototypes by allowing Ford's right-hand man, Leo Bebe, who's played by Josh Lucas, who you absolutely want to punch by the end of this film, who kept interfering with talk of things like doing things the Ford way and wanting to change design elements that didn't help the car actually get faster. And one of the ways he did that was by questioning Shelby's choice of the person who's actually going to drive at Le Mans, a British driver named Ken Miles, who's played by Christian Bale, who's, I'm guessing, his biggest flaw to Ford was that he wasn't American, but he also was a bit rough around the edges, especially with authority figures, so much so that he had trouble finding steady racing work, even though the guy consistently won. Miles was also a master at testing each new race car to make it more and more perfect, and eventually he did make his way to Le Mans. And I think Miles is by far the most interesting character in the film, if for no other reason than we see him outside of his racing environment. His extraordinary wife, Molly, who's played by, I'm going to get her name wrong, Catriona Balfa, understands what makes him tick, like few others do, and his young son Peter, who's played by Noah Jupe, who we'll talk about next week in a movie called Honey Boy, and he worships his dad and the cars that he works on. Ford versus Ferrari is not exclusively a racing film, but the sequences that involve racing are, I think, exceptionally crafted using camera work and, I'm assuming, special effects to create something so immersive and dangerous that you'll find yourself probably flinching and sweating right along with the drivers. The perspective we get as other drivers wreck around Miles is terrifying, and they also really get a good sense of that sort of loopy tunnel vision that they get, especially when they're driving at night, and it feels death-defying. Mangold and his team make this type of street racing seem as dangerous as I'm sure it is, and make you want Miles just to finish alive. But every race features drama on and off the track, especially involving Shelby, again, battling last-minute adjustments with the Ford team, who want to introduce things during the race even, like new elements. The ultimate insult comes during Le Mans when Miles is asked to slow his lead to let two other Ford drivers catch up so they can potentially cross the finish line at the same time. In a strange way, this may be one of the few films that you'll ever see that practically advocates towing the line as a company man when the moment seems right, or if you know, just don't want to lose your job. There's a weird air of desperation to a lot of Ford versus Ferrari. These guys are kind of in it not for the money, but just because it's their life. Sometimes that desperation also comes from Henry Ford, who feels like he's being judged by those around him for just not being the success that his father was. But often the desperation comes from Shelby and Miles, who know that they can do the job if only they've been left to their own devices. It's an age-old story of visionaries being stifled by these small-minded weasels who just happen to run the show. And a great deal of the movie becomes these two impressive men finding creative ways not only to design cars but to avoid the brass. Like the cars they built, the film is greater than the sum of its parts, and it's another, in my estimation, it's another feather in the cap of superior storytelling by James Mangold.
Okay. All right. Eric, what do you think?
It's one of my lesser James Mangold films, actually. I could just never sort of rev up a decent level of engagement with the story. For me, a lot of it felt a bit too by the numbers. Even at 2.5 hours, and a lot of potentially really interesting storylines. I think that themes that they could have explored a bit further in this movie. They just seem to just go around and round the circles, which is exactly why I've never been interested in racing to begin with. Not that you need to be completely interested in racing, though I think that anyone who is a racing fan will get more from this movie than I did. And something Steve sort of talked about there, a bit, is I think one of the reasons why I had a problem early on in sort of really finding my lane, if you will, with this movie, in that it essentially is the story of one giant American corporation trying to seek revenge on a foreign corporation. And the entire movie, even though it's mostly told through the eyes of the lesser people on the totem pole, namely Damon and particularly Bale, there's still this sense that they're working for the man, and they're just trying to gain more glory for a group that was slipping at the time financially, and this is a way for them to sort of work their way back into the global consciousness. And I thought that they could have leaned a little bit more into the idea of Bale being the character that certainly knows more than anyone else in the film about cars and certainly about driving cars, but he's just so temperamental that no one wants to listen to him, and instead of him being the guy that has the real sense of expertise, and because he's lower on the totem pole, he's eventually going to get screwed, and eventually when things transpire in that direction, it just feels like It didn't quite register, and maybe because of the length of the movie, and I was just sort of growing more and more disengaged with it as it went along. I wanted more, a bit more between Bale and Damon at odds with each other. I think those are some of the better scenes in the movie. Josh Lucas shows up and does this role. It may as well just be deemed the Josh Lucas role from here on out, because that's exactly what I expect from Josh Lucas when he shows up in a movie nowadays. Tracy Letts does some good stuff as Henry Ford, but ultimately at the end, I didn't feel that engaged with the story.
Okay, all right, let's take a break, guys. Hang on. Mm-hmm. Eric and Steve are going to hang on. We'll come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Ford versus Ferrari, and then now we got another movie to review right after we take a break here on 720 WG. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. We got a Blackhawks Express from last night's victory. Great weekend for the Hawks. Really, really great. And we also have top-selling novelty gifts of all time. We'll talk a little SNL as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312-981-7200. And Eric and Steve are here. Monday morning movie reviews continue. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
I'm kind of in the middle of both of you guys on this one, Ford versus Ferrari. There were parts of it. First of all, I think it's way too long. There's no need for this movie to be 2.5 hours long, so it feels very long. There were some compelling things in it, and I thought the chemistry between Matt Damon and Christian Bale was really terrific. I think they worked very, very well together on screen. And Christian Bale is just so great to watch in anything, and he's very, very, very good in this movie. I thought Tracy Letts was awesome. I mean, I happen to love Tracy Letts, but I thought he was awesome in this. It was a nice, juicy role for him, in this, like, a prestige movie. Interesting. I thought the movie was interesting in terms of, the historical aspect of it. I didn't know a lot about this. This is not, not one of my, I'm not a racing guy. I'm not a car guy at all. So this is not in my wheelhouse at all. But I was pretty much compelled for most of it. It was hard for me to care, about what was happening in the movie. There was no emotional heft to it. There was nothing on the line for me. I just didn't find it as compelling as I could have. But everything about it is like beautifully mounted. It's a good looking movie. It's well cast. Lots of really good performances in it. It's a story that I don't find very compelling. And, even if I'm not interested in a topic, I should be able to watch a movie about it. But I was not compelled by this at all. Good performances all the way around. Good looking movie. I wouldn't not recommend it to a lot of people. But I was hindered by it. Didn't care really. And it was too long. So those are my thoughts. OK, Steve.
Yes.
Tell us about Marriage Story.
All right. Buckle in.
Yeah.
So this is the latest from writer-director Noah Baumbach, who has given us an incisive and compassionate love story, but told from the perspective of a marriage breaking up, but hopefully a family kind of staying together. Our buddy Adam Driver is back as Charlie, a New York experimental theater director, and his wife is Nicole, played by Scarlett Johansson, who is the lead actress in most of his shows. She had a little bit of fame when she was a teenager and really hasn't had any, but getting involved in his theater group has sort of benefited both of them, because it's made her a higher profile actress and made him and as a result that has made him a higher profile theater director. She gets a TV pilot offer in LA where she was born and raised, and heads out there with their young son while Charlie continues to prep work for their upcoming show. The agreement was that she'd shoot the pilot and return to New York, but Nicole not only is reminded of how much she missed L.A., but that their agreement when they first moved to New York was that they would eventually return to California, and that's the thread that the fabric of their marriage unravels from. They're a young, hip couple, so they believe they can figure out their divorce without lawyers, but using a mediator. And but when they start to fight about custody and where their son's going to live, out come the lawyers, including her very sharp attorney, played by Laura Dern, and his slightly less sharp, sharp as a marble maybe, a lawyer played by Alan Alda, who is later replaced by a genuine shark, played by Ray Liotta. If you do have just one takeaway from Marriage Story, it's that lawyers suck and that all they're good for is draining bank accounts. I think we can all agree on that. But the other, like, my guess is that your reaction to Marriage Story is going to be partially determined by the baggage you bring into it, either like by a personal experience or that of someone you know. The truth is, Bombeck is very careful not to make either Charlie or Nicole the bad guy. They both make mistakes. They're both selfish in equal measure at different times, because they both still love each other and would rather not be a part of this process, although some of the events that leads to, you may think differently. There's an incredible sequence in Charlie's new L.A. Apartment that is a hostile screaming match like no other they've ever had, probably. They just unleash every pent-up emotion about their situation almost from the day they met, and it is one of the toughest scenes I've had to watch all year. There are times when you're likely to cry, especially in scenes involving lists that the couple make during counseling, that list the things that made them fall in love with each other in the first place. And they're read at different very key moments in the movie, and it's incredibly emotional. The idea that Johansson was going through a divorce during the making of this movie is almost too awful and perfect. Marriage Story is a film built on pure emotion. It's sometimes very funny and very sweet, and at other times relentless and difficult to handle. It's interesting that one of Bombeck's earliest films, The Squid and the Whale, was also about divorce, but told from the child's point of view, and he's grown as a filmmaker. He's been through some things, and this film reflects that beautifully. I think it's one of the year's best, and I feel like we've been saying that a lot lately, but I think it's true. And it's I should mention, because it's my job, that it's playing exclusively in Chicago at the Music Box Theater in 35mm, and then it debuts on Netflix on the 29th.
Okay. Eric.
Yeah, this movie is an experience. And I have known people that have gone through divorce, probably not with firsthand knowledge directly, but I've known them. I've never been married myself, but between this and Gone Girl, I don't think I ever will. everything Steve said about this is correct. You could pretty much label best of attached to just about anyone associated with this movie. And I have, Nick, you pointed this out when I reviewed the movie from Toronto, that, Noah Baumbach has not exactly been my cup of tea over the years. There have been a few things that I like Greenberg and the Meyerowitz stories, but other things that have drawn great praise, like Francis Ha, even The Squid and the Whale, to an extent, I have not been really on board with. But this is a home run. This is an absolute home run. And like Steve said, these lists, which is this brilliant framing device that Baumbach opens the movie with, really kind of sets us up for the this roller coaster ride of how we're going to interpret these people. We might feel like we want to side with one over the other and go into our corners, men supporting the men, women supporting the women, and whatnot. And up to the point that the papers are delivered, when they finally, when one character finally decides that this is what has to be done in order to sort of make the next step in their lives, it's alternately like the funniest scene in the movie and, you know, also the most heartbreaking in the way that it transpires. And that's, you know, a way that this movie goes through. I mean, once the lawyers get involved, then we kind of are given villains in a way, but at the same time, if you're supporting what these characters are going through, you kind of realize that some of the advice that they're getting from their lawyers is kind of absolutely essential to them to get what they need and want. You know, the three lawyers, Laura Dern, this unbelievable in this movie. Unbelievable. You want to talk about, you know, we just talked about Charlie's Angels and its sort of speechifying about feminism. Wait to hear Laura Dern talk about it in this movie. It's, you know, it's like, you know, it's cutting you with glass. Alan Alda is the sort of the nicer lawyer, is kind of the guy you don't want to be representing you in a way. And then Ray Liotta has not been this good in years. Ray Liotta is fantastic in this movie. Praising Adam Driver is just comes with the territory. He's spectacular in this movie. I think this is the best thing Scarlett Johansson has ever done. I don't think she's ever been better in a movie. This fight sequence that Steve referenced. Fights between couples in movies, I think more often than not, tend to feel written. They tend to feel phony. This is the best verbal fight sequence I have seen since Before Midnight. It's at that level. And as movies about divorce, this ranks up there with Shoot the Moon and The War of the Roses. And I think that Baumbach has crafted something that a lot of couples, this movie might even cause a few divorces. Who knows? But at the same time, it might, in a time that so many people need to find healing in some way and find peace through themselves and for their families. This feels like an essential piece of cinema that a lot of people will need to experience.
Okay. Hang on, guys.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric, Steve, hang on. When we come back, I'll let you know what I thought of Marriage Story, and then we got the box office to talk about, too, right here on 720 WGN. Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories of a beautiful downtown Chicago, here until 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time, and much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. We're talking about the Monday morning movie reviews. Here is Eric. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Yeah, this movie killed me. I've been divorced twice, and it's not a pleasant thing. The one thing about the only positive thing about the two times that I have been divorced is that, you know, there were no kids involved and essentially no lawyers. And so watching this movie was just it depends. You know, like what you were saying, Steve, is like when you bring like your own baggage to it. And I've got a lot of baggage when it comes to this kind of stuff. And this is just an incredibly, incredibly powerful movie that works on every single level. It's devastating at times. It's also funny at times. Adam Driver, you know, is fantastic. But Scarlett Johansson is unbelievable. And as you mentioned, Steve, the fact that she was going through a divorce when they made this movie. I don't even know what to say. This is as powerful a movie as you're going to see all year. I think it's one of the best movies of the year. And you were right, Eric, when you reviewed it. Where'd you see it? Sundance?
Toronto.
In Toronto. It was. You were absolutely right when you were like, you know, you compared it to Shoot the Moon, and that's high praise because Shoot the Moon to me is one of my favorite. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. One of the greatest movies ever made about divorce, without question, and a devastating, devastating movie on every level. And this is right up there. And that's for me. That's incredibly high praise considering how much I love Shoot the Moon. But this is a beautiful movie. It's absolutely beautiful. Now I'm a Bombeck fan. Eric, I know you're not really, but I've pretty much been on board with all of his movies without question. But I think this might be the best thing he's ever done. So it's a devastating film. It is, but it's absolutely brilliant. I think one of the best movies of the year.
So. Let me add one thing that just because Eric mentioned something about that fight scene that I've seen a couple interviews with Scarlett Johansson talking about shooting this, and she said that every single word, every pause, every broken sentence is scripted. And if you missed one word, you would have to shoot the scene again.
Oh, man.
So, like, nothing in here is improvised, even though especially that scene feels just so raw and right off the top of their very angry heads.
Yeah.
But, man, every word is scripted. And I got to say, like, it's like doing a play. Like, it's you have to get it right. And that just makes it all the more remarkable when you actually see it.
Yeah. It's also weird. I brought a lot of baggage to this one as well because my first wife was an actress that I directed in plays.
You should be suing for royalties.
It got under my skin, man, big time. So anyway, all right. Well, there you go. Marriage Story, one of the best movies of the year, playing at the Music Box. What do we got next week?
A lot of stuff, actually. We got Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Hanks. We got Frozen 2.
Yeah.
Steve mentioned Honey Boy, the Shia LaBeouf film. 21 Bridges is next week with Chadwick Boseman.
Oh, that's next week? Oh, I thought that was... Okay, all right.
No, it's next week. And Dark Waters with Mark Ruffalo, the Todd Haynes film.
Yeah.
And Waves, Trey Edward Schultz's
film. By the way, we're not on next week. I'm on vacation for Thanksgiving week, so we won't be reviewing anything. We'll play catch up the following week. Okay,
we'll be reviewing Knives Out then too.
Okay, yeah, I can't wait.
Make a point, Nick, of seeing Honey Boy though.
I will.
I think you're gonna love it.
Yeah, I definitely will.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, we'll talk to you. Steve, we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks, buddy. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Thanks, you too.
Okay, man. And then Eric, you're gonna stick around here.
Yeah.
And we'll talk box office.
Sounds good.
Okay, so the number one movie of the week is Ford versus Ferrari at $31 million. That, to me, seems more than I would ever have expected it to make. I don't know why.
When I originally was, weeks ago, maybe over a month ago, looking at the numbers for this, I thought that this might be, kind of like a $60, $70 million film overall.
Yeah.
Draw a little, general interest and, kind of fade away. But, the closer I got to it, the more, they've been advertising the hell out of this movie. Looking at just the way that this thing is going to play out, this thing seems destined it's going to be in the top five probably until mid-December. And I think that, the $31 million opening that it started with, this is a very good chance of getting over $100 million.
Yeah, I never would have thought that. I was fascinated by the fact that it made $31 million. I just never would have thought that.
Well, it's funny that, I don't know if I mentioned this at Toronto, but it seemed like everyone out of Toronto was going around describing it as like, oh, this is going to be your dad's next favorite movie. not your, but just everybody's dad's next
favorite movie. That's great. That's actually a really great way to describe it, actually. All right. Man, there's a big drop-off between number one and number two.
Yeah.
Midway, $8.7 million, $35 million total.
Yeah, this is bad. I said this last week. Midway, kind of shocked everyone by hitting the number one spot, but that was not a good number for a $100 million production.
Yeah,
that is probably going to have limited international appeal. So the fact that this movie is, probably headed, to less than $60 million in the U.S. is just not a good sign for this movie.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, boy, number three, Charlie's Angels, only $8.6 million. People do not want to see Charlie's Angels, I guess.
No, and despite what Elizabeth Banks is now coming out and saying about it, which is really unfortunate, I think that their first clue should have realized that in 2011, we didn't bring this up, but if you remember, they tried to reboot the TV series.
That's right.
In 2011, and it lasted 3 weeks.
Yeah.
On on the air. 3 weeks for, you know, a name recognition reboot of a television show, and, you know, why they thought that 8 years later, you know, bringing it back. And frankly, you know, not that people weren't, you know, not that they just weren't interested in it, but they didn't, I don't think they helped themselves at all. You know, Kristen Stewart's really the only name in the movie.
Yeah.
People don't, you know, really know who the other two women are, and, you know, fortunately for them.
Yeah.
And I think that hurt it big time.
Yeah, I agree. But that's still a much lower amount of money than I thought it was than I thought it would make.
Yeah, it's bad.
Bad. Number four, Playing with Fire, $8.5 million, $25 million total for your John Cena comedy.
Yeah, probably headed to somewhere in the vicinity of $40 million, but you know, they spent, you know, not a great bit of money on this, but enough that this is not looking like a hit either.
Yeah. Number five, Last Christmas, $6.7 million, $22 million total.
Yeah, same bag, probably going to be somewhere around $35, $36 million, and it's pretty well internationally, I guess, this weekend, so they might be able to save it overseas.
Okay. Boy, oh boy, Dr. Sleep.
Yeah.
Oh, man. $6.1 million, $25 million total. What the hell?
Yeah, no, people, 2.5 hour Stephen King adaptation in November. People said, no, do that later, do that earlier.
Yeah.
And this thing, you know, might not hit $35 million.
That's a shame, too, because I think it's terrific.
I agree.
Yeah. Number seven, The Good Liar, $5.6 million.
Yeah, not certainly not a great number. I think a little bit better than some people expected. Only a $10 million budget, though, and probably you'll draw a few bit of interest overseas. So not exactly a catastrophe for Warner Brothers.
And then Joker continues to make money. It's up to $322 million just in America.
The first R-rated film ever to gross $1 billion.
I don't understand this at all.
I just don't get it. And if you believe the reports, the film that Donald Trump watched in the White House last night.
Oh, okay. All right. Number nine, Maleficent, Mistress of Evil, $5.2 million, $106 million total. That's significantly less than the first one made, right?
Certainly domestically, yeah. I mean, it's going to come in around $250 million less than worldwide than it did, but $140 million of that is just here in the U.S.
Jeez. All right, and then number 10 is Harriet, $4.7 million, $31 million, almost $32 million total, which is pretty solid, right?
Yeah, it's not a bad number for a small-budgeted film, Cozy Lemons, you know, $31 million for that, for, you know, a history movie that, you know, they kind of had some Oscar hopes for. I don't know if that's going to come to fruition.
Yeah.
But the fact that made the top 10, and you notice what title we did not mention in the top 10 this week.
Which is?
Terminator.
Oh, well, yeah.
Here's the stat of the week for you.
Mm.
Terminator Dark Fate, the first movie to open at number one and not spend 3 weeks in the top 10 at the box office since Texas Chainsaw 3D. In 2013.
Wow. All right. There's a fact for you right there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What are we?
2 weeks in the top 10 Terminator spec.
Wow. Man, oh, man. Well, what are we looking at next week for, you know, I mean, a lot of stuff is coming out. What do we think is going to be the biggest one?
Well,
Frozen
2 is going to be huge, and I think Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood is going to be a very solid second as well. I think that that, and especially over Thanksgiving, I think that movie is going to be this year's wonder.
Yeah. I can't wait to see it. I can't wait to see it. Okay, well, there you go. We're off next week. Have a great Thanksgiving.
You too, man.
All right, Eric. Take care, buddy. There you go. Eric and Steve will be back. I'm off next week, so we'll be doing it in a couple of more weeks. And we're getting to the year-end stuff, too, which is going to be fun. All right, let's take a quick break here on 720 WGN.